Shakaparshnigrahina, who was helping Lord Indra, Vishnana, by Lord Vishnu, Manyuna, with anger, Shoka, Dittena, kindled by lamentation, Jwalanti, burning. Paryat Chintayat, thought. Translation. Sri Shukadeva Goswami said, just to help Indra, Lord Vishnu killed the two brothers, Hiranyaksha and Hiranyakashipu. Because of their being killed, their mother, Diti, overwhelmed with lamentation and anger, contemplated as follows. This verse is the first of a series of answers given by Maharaj Pariksit in appreciation, given by Shukadeva Goswami in appreciation of Maharaj Pariksit's very condensed questions regarding the essential topics of the introductory verses of this chapter. Since Maharaj Pariksit inquired very respectfully and very briefly, meaning getting right to the essence of what's being the significance conveyed in the introductory verses, Maharaj Pariksit, very inspired, very encouraged by Maharaj Pariksit's eagerness to get to the essence of the lessons imparted in this chapter, was very inspired to respond by this series of verses, and I'll read through them because we go through a few before there's a purport. Next verse. This is actually Ditti's thoughts. This is what she's thinking. Lord Indra, who is very much fond of sense gratification, has killed the two brothers, Hiranyaksha and Hiranyakashipu, which is Diti's own sons, her twin sons, by means of Lord Vishnu. Therefore Indra is cruel, hard-hearted, and sinful. When will I, having killed him, rest with a pacified mind? You can see the attitude that's betrayed in the words of these thoughts. When dead, the bodies of all rulers, known as kings and great leaders, will be transformed into worms, stool, or ashes. If one enviously kills others for the protection of such a body, does he actually know the true interest of life? Certainly he does not. For if one is envious of other entities, he surely goes to hell. Diti thought, continued to think, Indra considers his body eternal, and thus he has become unrestrained. I therefore wish to have a son who can remove Indra's madness, meaning kill him. Let me adopt some means to help me in this. Purport by His Divine Grace, Sisi Bhaktivedanta Swami Sri Prabhupada. One who is in the bodily conception of life is compared in the Shastras to animals like cows and asses. Diti wanted to punish Indra, who had become like a lower animal. bear in mind that these verses of Shukadeva Goswami are not in and of themselves revealing the absolute truth. He's revealing Ditti's mentality by revealing her thoughts. And her mentality is what Shukadeva Goswami wanted to hear about, and what Maharaj Pariksit wanted to hear about. So, Ditti, she's very interested in the way she's thinking. She was thinking that just to help Indra, Lord Vishnu killed the two brothers, Hiranyaksha and Hiranyakashipu. That's really not factual. Lord Vishnu appeared to kill Hiranyakashipu because, as foretold by that ominous voice, as soon as that demon tries to kill his second son, Kalat, I will appear to annihilate him. So it wasn't to help him. It was actually to protect Pallad. That was the first fallacy in your thinking. So Ditti, overwhelmed with lamentation and anger due to losing her sons, her mentality became very bewildered. And then the next verse becomes more obvious. Lord Indra, who's very fond of sense gratification, has killed the two brothers, Hiranyakashipu and Hiranyaksha. Lord Indra did not kill them. Lord Vishnu killed them. So it's very interesting to see how she's thinking. Because this chapter is, Maharaj Pariksit's answers to Shukadeva Goswami's questions. The initial question was, how is it that Ditti, who generally gave birth to the demons, whereas Aditi generally gave birth to demigods, and Lord Balaram, but how is it that her 49 sons, who should have been demons, became demigods? And also, remember, as the grandson of Ditti was Prahlad Maharaj, in whose family took birth Bali Maharaj, who was the recipient of Vamana's mercy, born with Ditti. So you see an interaction here of the divine and the demoniac mentalities taking advantage of different thought processes in the characters' minds. It's interesting to see how Ditti, because of her anger and lamentation at losing her sons, and to the hands of Lord Vishnu, such a benediction, such a blessing for me. But she's very aggrieved, and she's blaming Indra here for killing her sons, even though Indra had little to do with it. Vishnu did it. And this betrays the mentality of the conditioned mind, who is so prone to blame others and blame circumstances for our own suffering. And the thoughts of Ditti make it very clear how the conditioned mind works. What is really, ultimately, the work of the Lord in our lives, in hearts, and relationships? We superficially attribute to being due to other jivas or circumstances and the environment. And we tend to play victim. We tend to blame. And in this way, perpetuate the cycle of karma, meaning actions work upon us and our reactions perpetuates the cycle of karma, action and reaction, karma, rotating us continually in the wheel of samsara. And continues our victimhood to the unwanted miseries of birth, death, disease, and old age. But really, our deepest issues of duality, meaning attachment and hate, and the fear that naturally accompany those thoughts of duality, are not at all with the people we identify them with, but are actually with Krishna. So Krishna consciousness means adjusting our vision from the darkness of the light eclipsed by our own false ego to the light of Vasudeva, the illuminating power of the Lord. And Krishna consciousness also means adjusting our relationships with others, with circumstances, with the environment. Understanding nature to be a form of the Lord. His energy is really a chinta bheda, a bheda tattva, separate and distinct from him, but simultaneously one with him. So the Lord is working in the lives of everyone and everything through his delegated energy, known as Mahamaya, inasmuch as our attitude is averse to the surrender and service to the Lord. And that same energy in Mahamaya, who is personified as Durga, and is for some reason worshipped by some, desiring material benefits, but is really not the kind of personality who would evoke love from the hearts of the living entity. Durga, although a great personality, rides a beast of prey, a tiger, carrying sword, implements of destruction, sword to sever the heads of those who worship her. Not really liking their kind of worship, their kind of attitude. And the trident, designating the threefold miseries with which she's always inflicting punishments upon living entities. But she is actually just the reflection of Yogamaya, the divine energy. And it's the same energy. And Srila Prabhupada cites the example of electricity, which can serve to heat or to cool according to how it's wired. If electricity is wired to a heater, it gives warmth. If wired to a refrigerator, it cools. But it's the same energy with different features, different faces. So the Lord's own inseparable energy has different faces, different features, which reveal themselves according to our own attitude. Whatever attitude we convey to the Lord's energy determines whether she will reveal herself as Durga, meaning the threefold miseries and perpetuation of the cycle of samsara with the actions and reactions which we ourselves perpetuate by our own attitudes and thoughts and reactions to the actions that come into our lives, or by a simple adjustment of consciousness to seeing everything and everyone that comes into our lives as a teacher from whom we have so much to learn. In the 11th canto, when King Yadu came across that avadut, because the king was very wise, he could understand that this avadut was an enlightened soul. And he asked him, how have you achieved such a state of divine consciousness? And the Yamadut replied, because they have so many gurus. And he began listing them, beginning with the earth, who teaches forbearance. You see on the surface of the earth these huge militant forces that gather with all their armaments and infantry and cavalry and armored divisions and airborne divisions and just go at it with one another and cover these huge battlefields with blood and carnage. And the earth is so forbearing. And she just processes all this fruit of bitterness and envy and recycles it into new growth, new opportunities. And then he went on through the 24, the wind, the sky, the young girl, the prostitute, Pingala, the wasp. What do you learn from a wasp? This insect was being killed by a wasp, was meditating on the wasp, being so racked with fear. All that little insect could think about was the wasp. And therefore that insect became a wasp in its next life. Hiranyakashipu is likened to a wasp. But what was Prahlad thinking when Hiranyakashipu was trying to kill him in so many ways? He was thinking of Krishna. And what came into their relationship? The Supreme Personality of Godhead, who liberated Hiranyakashipu and bestowed and revealed so much of his, because Lord Nrisimhadev, we like to worship because some people like blood and gory scenes of, but others they revere the half man, half lion incarnation. Lord Nrisimha, because he's so protective of the gentle, the innocent, the weak, the humble, the devoted. And therefore he naturally evokes so much love and surrender from our hardened hearts. So the energy of the Lord, which as Mahamaya works through natural events and circumstances, some very traumatic, some very nurturing, but all having the same desire in mind, that same energy which works as Mahamaya and influences others to come into our lives to praise us or insult us or encourage us or discourage us or offer so many things, but and we become like puppets and just react to the actions. But we do have free will. The Lord has imparted his parts and parcels with free will, which is a necessary factor in love, that we don't have to react to everything that comes into our lives as if we're helpless victims in the hands of material energy. We have the free will to respond in the devotional way, thinking that whatever comes is ultimately under the control of Krishna, who is so kind and loving and orchestrating everything to bring his lost flock back to the shelter of this eternal abode of loving pastimes. So that was very clearly perceived and revealed to us in the Srimad Bhagavatam by Vidura, the great prophet and well-wisher of Duryodhana, who is continually trying to inspire him to give up your attachment. Dhritarashtra, give up your attachment to this offense-personified son, Duryodhana, which is just destroying a whole dynasty. And Dhritarashtra knew he was right, but he was very attached. So the last episode in this long sequence of events was when Duryodhana could not tolerate anymore. Who asked for his advice, the son of the kept mistress? Drive him out of the palace, leaving him only with his life. So Vidura was hurt. He was pained that he was just trying to serve as the well-wisher of the family for which he was exiled. But he was also very grateful because he saw that the Lord's one energy was functioning. His Mahamaya, because of Duryodhana's aversion to the Lord, and Mahamaya, Yogamaya, for Vidura, liberating him from that family bondage and enslavement in the dynasty, which is being polluted by the envious mentality of Duryodhana. He saw it as a gate, as a doorway opening, that he could just dedicate his life to going on pilgrimage and wander throughout all the world, perceiving the various infinite aspects of Krishna's wonder in the environment and what it had to teach him about Krishna and direct him towards Krishna. So same energy. And Vidura saw it clearly, inspiring Duryodhana to vent his wrath more vehemently, which was for Vidura, liberation. It was his opportunity. He had done his best. And he saw that Krishna was now inspiring him to leave this abusive situation. And how do we know the difference? When to forbear, when to leave. There's a wonderful prayer. It's called the Serenity Prayer, which is a wonderful definition of wisdom. Lord, grant me the serenity to change the things I can, to accept the things I can't, and the wisdom to know the difference. And from where does wisdom come? The three facets of Guru. The Lord above, the Lord who comes into our lives as a spiritual master, and that Lord in the heart, who works his intuition, who speaks his intuition. So the Lord's one energy, which is simultaneously one with him and different in adherence to the philosophy of Jintavada Veda Doctrine, presents different faces in our lives according to our very attitude towards the Lord's service and our duty to surrender and how Krishna is working for our redemption. At the entrance to the most divine realm of Radha Kund is Shivakari, the lake of the guardian Lord Shiva, to that most holy abode. And when the Lord's internal energy, Srimati Radharani, with her divine entourage, was relishing pastimes of Krishna, and suddenly they heard this piteous cries of some innocent creature. And Srimati Radharani turned to her associates. What is this? How is it that such sounds of great distress and fear and anguish are being heard in the most joyous abode of Krishna's pastimes? So she dispatched Lalita to find out what was going on, who found that one sheep jackal who had just taken water from Lord Shiva's lake, being spotted by some children who chased after that sheep jackal with sticks to torment her. And she ran into a hole seeking shelter. And the children, being very mischievous and very arrogant, started fires at the holes to her home. And the smoke and the heat and the suffocation was tormenting her, and she was screaming piteously. What inspires people to do such things? What inspires people to eat meat? It is nothing but envy. Envy of the lives of others, which has something to teach us about ourselves. So hearing those cries in the abode where only peace and love should prevail, Lalita finding out what was transpiring, chased away those children and took that she-jackal to her mistress, Shivata. And that she-jackal, with tears pouring from her eyes, this is a Brijabasa story, but it's from scripture, fell at the lotus feet of Srimati Radharani, bathing her lotus feet with her own tears. And Sri Radha, the original form of the Lord's energy, her heart melting with compassion, which is her the nature which so deeply imbues her transcendental form, reassured that jackal with the guarantee of her eternal protection and blessed her with service in her loving pastimes with Krishna. And hearing that pastime, Tulsi just began to cry, being so overwhelmed with love and appreciation for the wonderful workings of the Lord's internal energy. And as she was crying and just losing her composure, Rupa Manjari, to comfort her friend, encouraged her to reveal to us more and more the wonderful divine nature and pastimes of Radhakund. So, the Lord so often presents the most essential truths in environments of conflict and contrast. When Maharaj Pariksit, the wonderful king who had such a wonderful birth because Krishna appeared in the womb of Uttara to protect him from the Brahmastra hurled by Ashwatthama, he saw Krishna in the womb, and that form of the Lord, that beauty, that protection, that mercy, that kindness captivated his heart, granting him the name Pariksit Inquirer. He was looking at everyone and everything as to detect an indication how to find that person again. His birth was wonderful. His life was wonderful. His death was wonderful. So when he was controlling his kingdom, and he was horrified to find a person dressed as a king beating the legs of a bull. And this was just after that bull, the emblem of religion, wandering throughout the land, came across cow, the symbol of the earth, who is herself a goddess, who is the most blessed planet in creation, the only one in the universe where Lord Krishna is blessed. Her heart, with a touch of his bare feet. Krishna appears in his various avatars on other planets, but he wears sandals. Only on Earth is he obliged to walk barefoot because he identifies himself with the herdsman of Gopas. Such a humble Lord is Krishna. And so blessed is the earth to be marked with the impressions of his bare lotus feet. So, anyway, the cow is the representative of the earth, our mother. The bull is a representative of God, our Father. And when they were conversing, and the bull was so concerned that the cow was in a pale condition, he said, "Why are you lamenting? Is it because the population of the earth is not following religious principles? Or because they're indulging in unrestricted pleasures of eating, sleeping, mating, and defending without following regulations, regulative principles?" Which follows the natural consequences of violations of the four legs of Dharma, the legs of the bull, austerity, truthfulness, cleanliness, mercy, which are violated by meat-eating, illicit sex, intoxication, and gambling. Is this why you're so aggrieved? Or have you lost your calf? So when Dharma was inquiring from Bhumi, uprights, no, first appeared the Shudra, lower than Shudra, Bhargava, but dressed as a king, meaning the personification of hypocrisy, Kali. And he began beating the bull as he was trying to discern the reason for the aggrievement in the cow. And this Kali had already destroyed three of Dharma's legs and was standing on one only, the leg of truthfulness, which is beginning to fail, when upright is Maharaj Pritchett on his beautiful horse with sword in his hand. And he was appalled. He could not imagine that such a thing could transpire in his kingdom. And he challenged that. He called him a Shudra. Who are you, posing as a king but acting like a Shudra? A little complimentary, because a Shudra would never do such a thing. Acting like a demon, really. But culture king Maharaj Pritchett addressed him as a Shudra. Performing this heinous act, destroying the reputation of my illustrious forefathers and their dynasty. And then he turned to the bull. He was actually seeking a statement of accusation so that he could punish the miscreant. And Maharaj Pritchett was astounded at the answer of the bull to his question, who has done this? It was obvious who had done that. But the bull answered, I can't really say who has put me in such a difficult situation of such suffering. I can't really say, because I am bewildered by the opinions of the various theoretical philosophers. So the bull, who was Dharma, speaking as a devotee, was alluding to the fact that without the sanction of the Lord, no one can inflict any misery or impart any pleasure on anyone. So he was indicating that Kali is merely instrumental. And then Dharma expressed, answering Maharaj Pritchett's questions according to the philosophy of the different theoretical gyanis, said, some say that our suffering is due to superhuman powers. Some say it's according to our own self. Some say it's karma. Some say it's nature. My dear king, judge for yourself who the real culprit is. And it's interesting that Dharma did not answer that it's Krishna who is aware of the suffering to come upon me. Because Krishna is not directly responsible for our suffering. Nor did he say that it's Krishna's deputed Maya Shakti, which acts according to our own fruit of activities. And he didn't say it was the Lord's mercy. Because he wanted the king to take action. If he just said, this is Krishna's mercy, then that would kind of discourage the king from punishing the miscreant. So Dharma wanted to encourage the king and protect the religious principles and warding off the advent of the age of Kali as long as possible. So this teaches, this bull, Dharma, is teaching us how to see things holistically. That ultimately nothing can happen without the will, or at least the sanction of the Lord. We don't want to say it's Krishna's will, because Krishna does not will that we be indifferent or antagonistic. He allows us to misuse our free will, because ultimately by suffering the consequences
will begin to inquire, why am I suffering? And what is the means to become free? Nor did Dharma reply that this is just Krishna's mercy that I'm being assaulted like this. He knew it was Krishna's mercy, but he wanted to encourage the king in his service of granting protection. So he didn't say that. He told the king to judge for yourself and act accordingly. And then the king realized that this is no ordinary bull and cow. This is the archetypal bull and cow. Dharma and Bhumi are archetypal parents, representative of our true divine mother and father. Krishna is the father of all seed-giving living entities. Srimati Radharani is the mother of devotion and the mother of creation, the divine mother. So, the king, Maharaj Parikshit, responded to Dharma that you know religious principles, and one who thinks the perpetrator of injustice is the cause of his misery is as ignorant as the miscreant himself. And because you're just tolerating all this misery as God sent, I can understand that you are some exalted devotee. So then he arrested Kali. But then, when he was just ready to sever his head, Kali surrendered. He said, please grant me some kind of shelter. And he said, okay, you can live wherever there's meat eating, illicit sex, intoxication, and gambling. Now these are the blatant places where Kali can live. But meat eating doesn't just refer to eating the flesh of other living entities. It means any kind of cruelty, any lack of kindness, to some subtle or grosser degree, is malice, which is nothing but the expression of our original enemy, our own envy of Krishna. So, Kali said, but there is no such place in your kingdom where these things happen. So, you didn't give me shelter because you gave me a place that doesn't exist. Because under the protection of such a great soul as Maharaj Krishna, these things, and Kali had not really yet entered. He couldn't. Actually, Krishna's Leela extended a little bit beyond what would normally be, by astrological calculations, the close of the Dwapara Age. And a little bit into the, like 25 years into the, what would normally, by astrological calculations, be the advent of Kali. But Kali couldn't enter. As long as Krishna's lotus feet blessed the surface of the earth, Krishna had no place. When Krishna left, then Maharaj Pariksit, as his representative, was keeping Kali outside of the universe. But then, when Maharaj Pariksit's pastimes reached the stage that he would identify Kali before leaving, he gave Kali the benediction that you can reside wherever there is hoarding of gold, meaning selfishness. Selfishness, the manifestation of false ego with its ignorance of bodily identification, is the root cause of all our sufferings because it's what leads us away from Krishna. Not that anything can ever be apart from Krishna, but our own consciousness, our own thoughts, can create a world of darkness, which appears to be real, but is not real in a substantive sense of being eternal. Thank God. But this world is meant not to punish the living entities for their envious mentality, and not to award them enjoyment, because it doesn't do very well either. The enjoyments here are definitely not substantial. And the punishment is not the Lord's will. Our redemption is His will. So the world is perfectly designed to correct our envious mentality, to adjust our deviant perception and thoughts, into understanding that Krishna is working as guru, as one who comes to give siksha and diksha and the Lord in the heart and the Lord above. And if we actually seek the wisdom that the Lord is trying to impart upon our darkened eyes and darkened hearts, then everything reveals a different face. That which is external energy and takes us away from the Lord reveals her actual feature as Yogamaya, who affects the union, the communion of the individual soul with Krishna, and redirects our vision from seeking pleasure in the darkness to seeking shelter in the light. So, to reinforce the concept that our real issues are not with those jivas or those circumstances or those calamities that come into our lives, but these are just aspects, just the fructification of what stems from our initial misuse of our independence to turn away from Krishna rather than to serve Krishna. Of course, we don't emphasize service to Krishna because that is also arrogant, because Krishna is really only served by Srimati Radharani and Balaram. Everyone else is servant of the servant of the servant. There's only two people who really claim to be servant of Krishna. That is Srimati Radharani in the realm of Madhurya and Lord Balaram in the four different rasas, the four other primary rasas. Everyone else is servant of the servant of the servant. So, the real issues that torment our minds are not with other jivas. Those other jivas, those circumstances, those natural calamities and disturbance and arrangements are just the face of either our issues with God, or if we look at it in a more devotional, humble way, our teachers come to teach us something about the condition of our own hearts. If someone comes and says something, I don't know, I guess in modern terminology, they use terms like pushing buttons. Like somebody comes and pushes your buttons. I guess that means they get you angry or insulted. Is that what it means? So that means you become like a computer, that you're just reacting to how you're programmed. That's not what the jiva is meant to be, a computer or a robot who just gets programmed by something extraneous to himself, having nothing to do with his own heart's desire. That is not the goal and purpose of human life. To be a computer or a robot, that anybody can come along, you know, push certain buttons to program you to get angry or envious, or cruel, or mean, or arrogant, or abusive. That means you have achieved a status. Of course, people think that computers are very worshipable and exalted, but, you know, Krishna didn't, Nanda Maharaj didn't have a computer, and Mother Yashoda didn't have a typewriter. It's not that Krishna wasn't aware of these conveniences and advances in the, he didn't like it. He preferred loving relationships where people have the independence to interact lovingly and truthfully. And if you're actually, you know, completely abstain from any falsity, you can actually alter other people's behavior in a divine way. Like Lord Garanga, traversing the jungles of Jarikanda, And Brother Charya was, you know, just getting intimidated, like, because, you know, often there'd be tigers and lions in the path. And Lord Gaurangya just put his lotus feet on the heads of those tigers and tell them, honey, and they just jump up and start dancing. And he was just laughing at all the fun. And Balabhadra was just looking around in wonder. And then when the deer and the does were following Mahaprabhu, just captivated by the sound of his chanting, he looked and he reverted back to the previous lila. And that forest became Vrindavan as far as he was concerned. And he told Balabhadra, and told the world, through the words of Kaviraj Goswami, blessed are these deer, because they've approached the son of Danda Maharaj, attracted by the sweet melody of his flute. Very interesting. They were actually attracted by the chanting of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. But that's functionally the same as Krishna's flute song, which calls our hearts back to his loving shelter in divine service. The Sankirtan of Mahaprabhu is not different from the flute song of Krishna. And it's calling us, like lost cows in the dark forest of material enjoyment, back to his loving shelter. And then, when those deer began dancing with those tigers, embracing one another, kissing, Lord Chaitanya said, Vrindavan is the transcendental abode of the Lord. There is no hunger, anger, or thirst to be found anywhere there. Hunger, anger, thirst, these refer to the hankerings of the... But everyone in Vrindavan is so satiated with the nectar of devotion, Mahaprabhu said. Vrindavan is the holy abode of the Lord, where there is no hunger, anger, or thirst. And even those entities who are incompatible in this world live together in transcendental friendship, as being demonstrated by the deer dancing with the tigers, embracing and kissing, all chanting, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Lord Gauranga emphasized that this world is the Lord's storehouse. There's really no shortage or scarcity other than in our own consciousness. How can you say that? This world is being so poisoned with pollution of the air and the water and the earth. It's turning into a cinder by the glorious achievements of modern technology. Called advancement, but totally regressive. And that's true on one level. But where does pollution start? It doesn't start in the factories. It starts in the consciousness. Pollution of air, you know, creation, whether nurturing or contaminating, progresses from subtle to grosser realms of manifestation. Pollution of the air, which is choking everyone's lungs, begins with pollution of the ether. And what pollutes the ether? Lies, falsity, especially when propagated by men who are supposed to be representatives of justice, like the high court barristers, who should be like Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, but oftentimes are just slaves of the attorneys, who are all accomplices as the worst thieves, proclaiming themselves high court justice, proclaiming lies, causing such pollution and contamination in the ether. And right here, in this sanctified temple, through the airwaves are going all kinds of radio signals, inducing us to be envious because your neighbor has more wealth than you. But Jesus said, do not covet thy neighbor's wife, or donkey, or cow, or servant, or maidservant, or anything. Well, it's very obvious that coveting your neighbor's wealth is just going to lead to conflict. So he said, well, I won't act on it. But the advertisements being proclaimed on the radio stations, which are sending their waves right through this room, right through our brains and hearts, are telling us, you got to get ahead, accumulate more and more. And if your neighbor has a new car, then you have to get a new car. So advertisement being perpetuated by technology is encouraging. Yeah, be envious. They can say, well, if I don't act on it, it won't create major disturbances and disruptions in relationships. But it will, because it's infecting your original relationship with Krishna, with envy of your neighbor, which is just the face that comes upon your original envy with him. But actually, the significance is deeper. That when you envy your neighbor's wife or cattle or donkey or whatever, it means that you think that that is the source of his satisfaction. You want his satisfaction, but that's too intangible to steal. So you'll covet his car or his cow or his donkey or his wife or his wealth or whatever. But satisfaction does not come from these external arrangements we make in our lives. Satisfaction comes from bhakti. The living entity who identifies with the body is so racked with fear, because you know what's awaiting. Pain, anguish, separation from those you love, association with those you hate, and then it all culminates in death. Nothing to look forward to from a bodily perspective. But a simple adjustment in consciousness that it's all Krishna's mercy. It's all the bitter fruit of my God-given misuse of my God-given free will to turn my back on Krishna's loving call. I'm not a victim. This is just the bitter fruit of my own thoughts of wanting and desire of being independent controller, enjoyer, Indra. So Dithi was thinking, that Indra, he's the cause of all my sorrow. It was her own Indra, her own desire to enjoy by having these nice sons, Hiranyakshi and Hiranyakashipu. And she thought they were nice sons. She didn't realize they'd been blessed, being liberated at the lotus hands of Lord Nisriya. And blessing her with a grandson like Pallad, who blessed another, and Bali Maharaj, who was blessed by another relative of her, Lord Vamana, the dwarf Brahmana, who just begged 3 footsteps of land, but got accused of like taking away everything. But what did he give? Himself. So whether Krishna gives or takes away, blessed is his holy name. He's trying to instruct us. He's trying to teach us. He's trying to call us back to his loving eternal shelter. And then when Mahaprabhu, her beloved Bhattacharya, saw that not only the deer dancing with the tigers, chanting Hare Krishna, but even the creepers and the trees and the bushes, they're all bowing down, shedding tears of honey, reaching out to clasp his lotus feet. The world is so blessed by the holy name. And even the barbaric tribes in that forest, hearing that holy name, they have become such exalted saintly souls that when they go back to their villages, everyone will become pure devotees just by their darshan. This is the blessing of this world. But it takes humility to make the heart fertile and receptive to the message of Mahaprabhu, which is so gentle, a message of surrender and servitude. And such sweet, gentle, loving relationships that blossom from that acceptance. It was very interesting the way, of course, you know, the old schools of thought, you know, the Vedic theology was upgraded to a higher level of intimacy, relationship with the Lord by the teachings of Krishna, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And the Old Testament was given a much deeper message of intimacy and love and trust by the teachings of Jesus, who would often paraphrase the Old Testament, as when Matthew explains how Jesus first cited the Old Testament, that you've heard it said that life for life, the old Hebrew law, but I say that if you go to make a gift on the altar and you realize that your neighbor has something against you, whether or not you're at fault is practically inconsequential. Go to him before you pray, before you make your offering, and try your best to reconcile. Then come back and make your offering and offer your prayers. Meaning that don't just go on with your devotion to the Lord if there is some enmity in your heart or someone else's heart towards you without trying to rectify the situation by humbling. And it's amazing how others' attitudes are just affected by our own. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, after giving so many vast instructions, and he condensed it all into Shikshastakam, of which the emphasis is on humility, as the qualification for properly chanting the holy name of the Lord. And it's so essential. Nobody likes a haughty mentality, which will not evoke sympathy from anyone. Whereas humility can evoke compassion even from peers, even those who are not normally very friendly or favorable. But to speak of the Lord who's just reciprocating with our own attitudes. So, by developing the qualities of humility and truthfulness, which means abstaining from falsity, which is the shelter of Kali, the personification of quarrel, who tries his best to incite quarrel amongst the assembly of Vaishnavas, because then his kingdom flourishes. It's Kali Yuga, in name only, because it's really the age when Lord Gauranga came to inaugurate the dawning of a golden age within the darkened time of Kali's reign. But it's not, Western technology can see this as largely being a rising up, like an insult, that since the kingdom of God has not descended from above like it was supposed to, will rise and raise it up from the ashes of this earth. But the kingdom of God, the golden age, is not something that's just going to blatantly reveal itself in the outer world. It begins within the heart. So, and it's not that anger is not, a potentially useful emotion, or fear. We're wired to respond in fear. Like if a tiger comes out on your path and comes after you and you don't have the potency of Mahaprabhu, you run. And fear gives you sufficient adrenaline and heartbeat and breathing capacity to get away, potentially. But fear and anger, sometimes it's, when there's injustice, it's not in the lives of, in the dealings of others, it's not that you should just, passively avoid responsibility by saying it's Krishna's mercy. Krishna's mercy is giving you the opportunity to act in a devotional way, to correct injustices to the extent that you have the ability. But we don't want to invite and cultivate fear and anger and kama, kodha, lobha, moha, mada, matsarya, the archetypal demons, the offspring of Kali. We don't want to invite them and host them in our hearts. They don't need invitation. They're always waiting. We don't want to harbor them, give them shelter. so they can fester and darken our lives by taking by giving foothold in the hearts. So, by humility, our whole perception of everything is changed. From here's my enemy who's coming to harm me, so I will retaliate, to seeing everyone as potentially representative of our Guru. And if we respond with humility, then everyone and everything will reveal that alternate feature, the Lord's internal energy, making arrangements for us to reconcile with Him and return to Him, to His eternal shelter, where every word is like song, every motion like dance, and everything is activated by the sound of Krishna's flute, which in this age takes the form of Harinam Sankirtan. Functionally non-different from the flute song of Krishna, because it incites loving feelings and humble demons in the core of our hearts, and gives us an opportunity to correct our deviant thoughts and correct our rebellious attitude and just with forbearance accept everything that comes into our lives as Krishna's mercy, offering gratitude and respect from the core of our hearts through our mind, body, and words. And then the Lord's energy will reveal her divine feature as the goddess of ocean, of devotion, come to train us for return to our homeland, where everything is eternal, full of knowledge, and the love and the bliss that follows loving, trusting relationships. Thank you very much. Are there any questions or comments?
It is very obvious in this situation. You can see that Diti is actually speaking these words because of her limited intelligence. But when we fall in such a situation, it's very difficult to see that. Because in this situation, we are not in the situation. But when we are in that situation, it becomes very difficult.
It's hard to be objective when you're subjective. The subjective is beyond your control. So how to detect our own deviations in thought? Is your question? That's when loving relationships are so precious. Because they will not be sweet and holy if there is some deviation in your own consciousness. And that's why, that's one of, you know, an infinity of reasons why Srila Prabhupada warned us, don't ever leave the association of devotees. Even though the devotees may bring more ordeal into our lives than the rest of the creation of the rest of Venus. That's what's teaching us, you know, what's wrong with us. Because what does it matter if we have the opportunity to serve? So yeah, our own thoughts, we are most deceived by our own thoughts, and we can become so bewildered while still thinking that we are so strictly adhering to the devotional principles. But in good association, it'll become very obvious that something's wrong. And the sweetness of Vrindavan is really just a matter of a certain nature of relationships. So when things start becoming bitter in our own taste, we know that there's something wrong in my own consciousness. So association is like a mirror, which helps us see what's actually what is inside. You can't see into your own heart, but it'll become obvious in the nature of your relationships, whether it's as humble as it should be or whether something's amiss. So association. Even though it may be totally unbearable to body and mind, it's essential for the cultivation of the heart.
One aspect is to be humble, just like as you said. Then comes some difficult situation comes on us, it's very obvious to blame others. But in some situations, like as we explained that Parikshit Maharaj,
when injustices befall others,
yeah,
your attitude should be quite different.
Yeah. So how to draw the line that whether we have to take a humble position in such a situation or we have to act in that situation?
It's the same thing. The most wonderful definition I know of wisdom, the element here is wisdom. So what's wisdom? The best definition I've ever heard of wisdom is that serenity prayer. God grant me the serenity to improve upon the things I can, to forbear and accept the things I can't change. And the wisdom is another difference. It's wisdom. And where does wisdom come from? It comes from the heart. It comes from the guru, but when he's not there to direct us, he's got his manifestation within. And he'll impart that wisdom according to, you know, how much we actually take shelter. And surrender. Surrender just means, you know, my own abilities will not give me protection or guidance. I use them to the best of my ability, but I have to be guided by the wisdom that comes from within, which helps us to discern what things we can and should change. What things we should accept. And basically, we should accept whatever comes to us, that if injustice befalls others in our association, we should try to correct it. But you know you're not the doer. It's not ultimately up to you. It's your duty to try to correct injustice. But really, there is no such thing as injustice. The only thing that's not just is mercy. Everything that comes to us is really justice. But there's a higher law, which is mercy. There's a higher department than the Supreme Justice Department of, where is that, Washington, D.C. or someplace, where they have all these egotistic sayings, the Supreme Justice. And, the only way you can avoid justice is by submitting to the Department of Mercy. Because whatever we get, it isn't justice, unless it's mercy. So, by us, you know, intervening where we see injustice means we should just try to bring more mercy to the situation, because that's our duty. But we're not actually, you know, ultimately able. We try our best according to, you know, as a matter of service. But for results, we have to depend on higher powers. And, you know, as we so oftentimes discussed in a worldwide institution, there's going to be all kinds of conflicts and problems, but there will not be any widespread or long-term preaching without the foundation institution. So it's racked with problems. And accepting those problems and trying to improve upon them to the best of our ability is a manifestation of our surrendered soul, the expression of our surrendered soul. So when we see injustices or improper dealings or whatever, in a humble way, we should try our best to, you know, improve and sustain the standard according to Gurudev's teachings. But no, it's not within our ability to really, you know, alter things, except as a servant can invoke the Master's mercy and energy. So therefore, when there's injustice, we should try in a humble way, and going through the proper authorized channels to improve upon the situation, but not be attached, thinking that it's your own doing. Because inasmuch as we think that anything is our own doing, we're far from Krishna. Inasmuch as we know that we're totally dependent on Krishna for any ability or any potency or anything, then Krishna will be with us and have worked through us. And actually, he can transform the worst situations into the best opportunities. But it's all in reciprocation with our own heartfelt desires and attitudes and consciousness. Okay. Yeah, basically, when injustices fall upon ourselves, we should just gratefully acknowledge Krishna first. But if that befalls others, fire to the rose.
Same principle, just different application according to different relationships. You can look at Shara, it says some question. You know, he's trying to teach us by his question.
When there are like million other things, but the slightest provocation comes, we get drawn instantly. But sometimes we call, sometimes we don't. But after we must be real, sometimes we do not. So, how to really check it?
How to what?
How to check the force. Which are the passion?
Read the prayers of Kali after serving to Krishna. He uttered one significant prayer in this regard. Kali was praying to Krishna that the condition of a servant is so intense that they naturally respond when somebody stomps on them. except for the disciple of Narada Muni in the form of the serpent. Generally, if you step on a snake, they bite. They don't just usually forbear being trampled upon. And what's that emblem? Somebody's got this emblem, don't stomp on me. Is it like the U.S. national anthem or something? That, yeah, don't stomp on us. It's a national emblem or something.
But don't trample on me.
Well, that's Texas.
Yeah.
Yeah, Texans are not known for being the most humble of Americans. don't tread on me. We got this, you know, serpent that, yeah, this is they're advertising their own consciousness. Okay, Kali's prayers. He said, you know, being a serpent, the condition is so intense for getting angry and biting. But you're dancing upon my hoods. Has relieved you of all that. So he is praising Krishna that your touch is so potent that it completely eradicates all that conditioning which is so intense and condensed anger and envy in the form of a serpent. So Kali is praising Krishna that your touch has corrected all that. So how is Kali relieved of all that envy and enmity which awards the body of a serpent? Krishna dancing on his hoods. So how can we achieve the same blessing of Kali? Because we all have the hoods of a serpent called the tongue, which is so likely to vent its wrath and poison at the slightest provocation. But the more we keep Krishna, Prabhupada said, keep Krishna dancing upon your tongue, which is a nice way of saying that you have an attitude like Kali. But you also have an opportunity like Kali. Keep Krishna dancing on your hood. Now at first, Kali didn't like it. Those lotus feet of Krishna, which are so tender and soft, that the gopis are reluctant to take them upon the softest parts of their hearts. The Kali was like thunderbolt, it's just cracking his skulls. And it like bring them down every time they rose up. And when they came down and another one rose up, Krishna would jump up on that one and bring it until they were all down. And all the fire and venom and poison was just gone and nothing, blood was coming out, meaning that the false ego was finished and he was forfeiting his egotistic life. And then he remembered what his wives had been saying all along, that Krishna, please deliver him. And he began to appreciate his wives. And his wives were disgusted with him. And they wanted to leave him, but they knew if we leave him, we'll just get another serpent like husband. So what's the use? So Krishna, they were praying, deliver him. Because they had that wisdom that, well, you know, we're in an abusive situation with this husband, Kali. If we just leave him, we'll just get out, you know, because Matadis, they seek protection. So they knew that they would just get, assume another, just get the shelter, the protection of some other serpent-like character. So they just, what's the use? Krishna deliver him. So like Kali, we have a similar opportunity that by Krishna dancing on our tongues, we'll be relieved of all that envy and enmity. We're so awaiting an opportunity to express this in self, invent itself. But Krishna's touch is so purifying and so healing and so redemptive that we'll end up like Kali expressing appreciation to Krishna for putting us in situations that just extricates all that poison and enmity, which is just torturing our hearts and relieving us of that overburden and liberating us to appreciation for his arrangements in our lives to free us from our own self-imposed bondage. Just keep Krishna dancing on your tongue, but to maximize the effect, Trinada Visanijayana Tathaka Visanishina. And service is such a wonderful redemptive activity. When you have an opportunity to serve, not just exalted souls, but even, simple people or humble and just, Sanatana Goswami was glorified by Srinivasacharya's father. These, Rupa and Sanatana are so humble. They're the most exalted persons in the world, but yet the most insignificant people come to them and they bow down and they serve them with such love and respect. So, when the most insignificant opportunities to serve arise and we answer the call, then Krishna reciprocates. Okay, here's an opportunity to serve. And your false ego says, no, I want to be served. I don't want to serve. But your intelligence is saying, no, I don't want to listen. I don't want to continue, resigning to the dictates of this tyrannical ego. Say, no, I'm not going to live. I'm going to serve. When you do, then Krishna reciprocates by giving a taste. And what is the taste? Of his nearness to our soul. And then just the slightest experience that you don't ever want to serve false ego again. And then when you're not suspecting, you're not attentive, it'll try to dictate from some, First it'll try to make you a little proud, and then it'll whisper in your ear something. You learn to identify it. That's the voice that's trying to take me away from Krishna's shelter. I'm not going to listen. I'm going to listen to my heart, which wants to serve, and respond accordingly. There's two basic attitudes to whatever comes into life. Reactive, which means somebody pushed your buttons. Respond, reacted like a computer, or response, which should be loving. It's the expression of the free will, the proper expression of the free will. Because what does freedom really mean? Freedom to love. And as long as we're reactive and egotistic, there's no freedom to love. You're just a machine, you're just a computer, and they are not loving. Okay. What is lust? It's contaminated love. So, if we have only lust, how can we give love? Then a wonderful question arises, that if we're acting lovingly, but we're really contaminated with lust to some degree or other, are we being hypocritical? No, not necessarily. If you act loving, even though you don't feel it, if you're doing it to deceive, that's hypocrisy. And Kali enters more forcefully. But if you're doing it to please, my Gurudev has given instructions that I should serve lovingly. And even if I don't feel like it, I'm going to act that way. Not to deceive, but to please. Not hypocritically, but sacrificially. If I'm acting loving, but I really have some lust in my heart, I'm not acting loving to deceive, but to sacrifice, because this is the way I've been instructed to act. And that instruction is according to my higher nature. It's not really duplicitous, it's really according to my higher nature. And by accepting that instruction and following it as a matter of sacrifice, what does sacrifice mean really? Sacrificing false ego. Then the internal awareness that yes, love is the nature of my heart, which somehow got polluted by my initial envy with Krishna. And how does it get corrected? By acting lovingly, even though you don't feel it, not to deceive, but to please Guru and Krishna by acting in a sacrificial way. If I don't feel totally lovingly, but I'm going to serve in that way, as if I felt that, because that instruction is according to my higher nature. By following it, my higher nature will be victorious over my lower. And then I'll actually get the feeling and the taste of Krishna's pleasure and Krishna's mercy, which is more powerful than even this archenemy of lust. So powerful, all devouring sinful enemy of the world, that there is a superior power which can destroy it, and it's called Krishna's mercy, which is more powerful than anything because it's his own internal energy. So that's what we are invoking when we chant Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama.
Before you were saying that we need association so we could understand what we're saying or doing within our heart, you know, to get, and then you say that we can hear within our heart and by the intuition, by Lord Krishna letting us, you know, giving us the wisdom. So I'm a little confused.
They go together. They're inseparable. Give an example. There was one devotee who just couldn't deal with his association in the temple. So he left the temple. And he decided that he was too advanced to have to deal with all these neophyte interactions that were plaguing him in temple life. So he left, out on his own, and became very advanced. He became self-realized, he was chanting 64 rounds a day. And when he became a pure devotee, he came back to the temple. And then he realized that all the issues that drove him away in the first place had just deceived him all the more, and then thinking that on top of that he became a pure devotee. And even though he was, you know, chanting 64 rounds a day, what are rounds? The syllables of the holy name are available anywhere, but the sublime spiritual potency living within them necessitates humility to access. So there are three predominant manifestations of Guru. Lord Nityananda, or his representative, be they Siksha, Diksha, Guru, who may be different, maybe same person, the Lord in the heart. And then there's the representatives of Guru. So, hearing the dictation of super soul means aligning the inner and the outer dictations. So you can't do it by seclusion, and you can't do it by social. You do it by a combination of japa, which means going into the heart, as a form of meditation, which is not most highly recommended in this age, and sankirtan, going into the relationships of devotional service. And by that combination, going into the heart and then expressing what's in the heart in relationships, the outer and the internal are aligned, that we will not be deceived by one or the other. So to actually train ourselves to follow the dictation of the Lord in the heart, we have to have devotional relationships. Because we can be deceived by the dictations of the heart, by another voice which mimics the super soul, that is actually subtly going to mislead us. But our relationships, our association, will make it clear enough if something is wrong in our own motivation, our own following of what we think to be the Lord in the heart. It'll make it clear if we're actually right or if we've been deceived. So devotee relationships, devotional relationships are essential for protecting us on many levels, in many paradigms. It will either confirm or reveal what is proper and improper as far as our understanding of the direction of our own intuition. So it's a combination, going into the heart in japa and expressing that in the relationships of Sankirtan. And it's only when the inner and the outer are actually aligned that we know we've found the integrity of the following super soul. Anything else? Thank you very much. All glories to Sri Prabhupada.
What?
That's about female servants.
Yeah.
So you can tell me if I'm too off course.
No.
If you can hear it.
I read it.
Oh, makes sense.
I copied it, too.
Oh.
Can I have the original and you have a copy?
Oh, I'm there. I'll just lose it. See, what happens is that I think my writing is so exalted, but on the first cold morning, I need to start a fire. It's the most available kindling.
Don't ever burn
your stuff. I always do. I'm going to save this, but then a cold morning and I can't quite start a fire. It's always the first thing I find.
Excuse me, I'll give you some newspapers.
So you have to give him something that he won't rip out of you.
I did give him a notebook. I don't know why he's not using it. I don't know why he's not using it.
Because I put it in the most obvious place, and then I can never find it. Hare Krishna, are you giving me mercy today, or what?
I did you mercy.
Thank you for tolerating me. You're giving me great encouragement. I can be tolerated with me. Some of your Vaishnavas, all your mercies, for them.
Actually act on it.
I'm ready.
Okay.
Yesterday we had, that's a two-part question. How they get perfection. Prabhupada answered that. They go to the planet where Jesus resides and he instructs them further. Which he himself said. Part of that. I have so much more to teach you, but you cannot bear to hear it now. So Prabhupada added the other sequence that they'll go sincere Christians, because so many in the West go under the name Christian, but the real Christians don't accept them. So, yeah, Prabhupada said they go to this planet. Very good question regarding Guru, because they don't have a formal parampara. But they do have parampara, because there's always been enlightened souls in that tradition. But they don't, they're not like, they don't like have a list in the beginning of Bhagavad Gita like we do to refer to. But there's always been enlightened souls oftentimes they're not part of the formal church. They're, you know, monks or desert fathers or here or there, but somewhere or other, there's always been enlightened souls in that tradition. We don't have the formal parampara that we do, but it's there, and the sincere followers, you know, find it.
So after that, they go to his planet,
and there they're instructed further. So Prabhupada said. Thank you very much.
Wondering by Krishna.
We're going to the Prabhupada's office to make revolutionary plans. Want to come?
Not especially. I'll wait till the revolution hits and deal with it.
Yeah, but you got the common sense that the
okay, I'm going to show Varshana what I showed you last night.
I think it always if you're overwhelms you, that giant variety. You got common sense.
I know.
If you're going to have a revolution,
most uncommon not, commodity,
then you're going to be there for a few minutes. Right? You're going to have a revolution, right?
Oh, we've been trying for so long to get it off the ground, but somehow the activating element of common sense and acting upon the words is not yet evolved.
I've got a calling real strong.
Oh.
And it won't take me very long.
Okay.
So I was just wondering, you do that for your last
I had the fourth of my ambitions to take the planet.